Hi, I'm John Schwannis, and this is Indiana Lawmakers. Think of us as a walking, talking playbill. Now, the production in question is, of course, the second regular session of Indiana's 123rd General Assembly, better known, thankfully, as the 2024 short session. And although the reviews have yet to come in, one thing is certain. Just because the session is short in duration doesn't mean it'll be short on energy, consequence, or drama. So, please find your seats. It's Indiana Lawmakers. From the State House to your house. Welcome to the Indiana General Assembly's 2024 session and to Indiana Lawmakers' 43rd season. Now we're kicking off the season with observations, insights, and predictions from some of the state's best political pundits, two people who understand and, better yet, can explain, more often than not, what can be, at times, a fairly convoluted process. Joining me are Brandon Smith, State House Bureau Chief for Indiana Public Broadcasting and host of Indiana Week in Review, and Oshia Boyd, Editor-in-Chief of Mirror Indy, part of Free Press Indiana. Thank you. Thank you.
Always enjoy doing
this. Thank you for having me.
Well, at the end of the session, when we have you back, we'll see how if you're as enthusiastic. And to that point, before we look forward at the next 2.5 months or so, let's look back. And my premise is that no session is an island unto itself. It's a continuum. Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, technically, this is the second session of the 123rd. So, I mean, officially, it's a continuation. So we had a busy session this last, it was a budget year, $44 billion budget. And a lot of things, wasn't supposed to be the culture wars. Of course, it erupted in culture wars.
Yes.
So what hangover do we have looking back? In terms of setting the stage, is there a lingering effect from last session, the 2023 session, that will actually affect what does or doesn't happen this time?
There always is, to a certain extent. But this year, I mean, legislative leaders, Republican legislative leaders, have been very forthright about saying, absolutely, it's going to affect what happens in 2023 is going to affect what happens in 2024.
Didn't they call it the transition year or the wait-and-see year?
Well,
I've heard different sort of labels.
So you have a Speaker of the House, Todd Houston, who even before he became Speaker, I mean, we used to have conversations where he decried the way that the short session, what we're coming into, the non-budget session, had sort of over time become like they were trying to cram just as much as they did in the long session into half the amount of time, it seems like.
And never mind that it started out as an emergency session.
And that was his point.
That's sort of a quaint thought.
There was a time when lawmakers didn't meet every single year. Yeah. They only met in that second year for emergencies.
It was a safety valve in case the sky was falling.
And over time that grew from, okay, we're going to do a few big things that absolutely have to be done too. It's become a regular session just in a compressed time frame.
And, of course, one of the things that nobody wants to get into the budget.
Yeah.
There are still bruises that were inflicted for the past session. How reasonable is that? Can there be a blanket agreement? And there is no agreement. But can leaders hold to their notion that this is not a budget year, so we're not going to open the state's coffers? Because it's hard to make a lot of improvements if there's no something on the table.
I really, at this point, don't think so. I think, okay, you passed the budget, sure, but we still have to talk about money every year. Every year we're talking about spending. So then how do you not talk about the budget? It's interesting about going back and thinking about how this was an emergency at one point, just we didn't have this session every year. Now we're going into where we're seeming to just have every year we're going longer and longer in emergency sessions and hearings. And so I wonder, are we going to get to where we're just going to be full-time all year round?
I'm going to move over here because I think the lightning strike may come down, and I don't want to have metal.
I will say this in terms of reopening the budget, literally. I mean, to your point, I absolutely think they're going to talk about money. I mean, that's a conversation that's continued since the last session. You have all of these study committees, and as much as we've talked about how study committees have lost some of their effectiveness, partly because lawmakers aren't using them in the most effective way anymore, there are some major ones that happen in 2023 that are being used effectively. The Medicaid Oversight Committee, the Healthcare Costs Task Force.
Which is now kind of morphed into a child care cost.
These things just keep going.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, the state and local tax Review Task Force, sure. The SALT Task Force, as it's being called. That's going to be a big one that we'll
play
on 2025.
I got my key here, my cheat sheet of all
right. But, I mean, in terms of actually spending money in the 2024 session, I think, as always, legislative leaders are saying, no, we can't reopen the budget. However, there's two things going on there. One, there is still the issue out there of the fact that talking about the impact that the 2023 session will have on 2024, one big thing that wasn't in the budget that I think all of us were pretty shocked at was support for people on public pensions in Indiana.
Which is a relatively small ask in many ways.
It's about, you know, $60 million to do one of two things, which is historically public pensioners have gotten what's called a 13th check in the state budget, which is one extra month of their monthly benefits. A couple years ago, lawmakers decided, hey, instead of doing a 13th check, let's do a 1% COLA, cost of living adjustment. Mm-hmm. So instead of an extra month, all of their monthly benefits went up a little bit. Well, this year, the House and Senate couldn't decide which they wanted to do and ultimately landed on nothing. Obviously, those 100,000 public pensioners were like, hey, what the heck, guys? After basically guaranteed that for 30-plus years, all of a sudden they were left without it. There's money sitting in an account right now that can only be used for that just isn't being spent. And lawmakers have said, that doesn't count as reopening the budget. That's money that's already there, so they may do something with that.
Because something, as we said before, things cost money.
That's interesting. So how many things don't count?
Well, if you've got money sitting around.
The money's already sitting around. The biggest thing that will prevent lawmakers from really reopening the budget in any significant way is something that happened towards the end of December, which is they got a new revenue forecast. Mm-hmm. As part of their revenue forecast, they also get a forecast on Medicaid spending. And, yeah, you see those numbers fluctuate, but that's not usually the headline-grabbing moment of the revenue forecast. Well, this time it was because, oops, the state Medicaid program went, sorry, turns out we need $1 billion for
that
Medicaid
in the
current budget than we thought.
Which gives people who don't want to do a lot and want to get out the door so they can go campaign in primaries and so forth, gives them justification. Say, we are
in a sense reopening the budget and that we have to now spend nearly $1 billion.
Yeah.
You know, and that seems like one of the default excuses. And again, I'm not trying to say denigrate. I mean, people can argue whether you should look back and do or just leave things, let them settle a little bit. And that's the other argument aside from the budget. You have things like healthcare containment initiatives and some of these other issues that, I mean, there was a public database that was, I think, created with legislation in 2020 that still has not gone operative. So there's this notion, the other thing we hear is, we got to wait. We're getting ahead of ourselves. We don't know what the problem is until we let the data catch up. How is that? Are we going to be hearing that a lot, do you think? Whether it's on healthcare cost containment or whether it's on
mental health spending.
Mental health, yeah. I mean,
education.
Well, they just gave the first grants to 86 of the counties.
So I think we're always getting ahead of ourselves because we never know how much things really cost. It's always an estimation. And then when you really get down to the data, you find out, oh, we didn't estimate enough money. So it's always kind of a going back. So that's why I don't think, I get that the budget's closed, we don't want to reopen it. But in real life, you don't close a budget and never go back. And, you know, you have to always revisit costs.
Well,
I think that's why we're always getting to this position where they're like, okay, well, we have a shortfall. You have a shortfall like with Medicaid because we didn't know it was going to really cost this much more. Things cost more now.
And even if it's not a budget issue, with cost containment, it might be, for instance, caps. We talked about that or non-compete clauses for physicians and whatnot. I mean, that isn't necessarily a state budget issue, but still, the data aren't there to know if, what has been enacted still in the works? We don't know
Absolutely. I mean, there is a compelling argument to say, listen, we have to let some of this stuff start to work because we have to find out if it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
If you just are, I mean, we've seen this in education. I mean, educators and even parents and students have been begging lawmakers for years, please stop.
Yes.
We've a new test, a new program.
Oh, yeah.
There was so much like
new
turnover
curriculum.
And change. Yeah, a new curriculum. So much of that over a period of like half a decade that they just felt like they didn't know what to do. And lawmakers didn't really slow down on that, but to a certain extent, you have to give things a little time to see if they're going to work. But what I note, though, is interesting, is one of the things that, again, Republican legislative leaders have said is, we did so many big things in 2023, we have to let them start to work and find out if they're working before we go and try and change, do big changes again. That's a very logical argument.
Yes.
But some of the things that are on their relatively limited priority list, things like reading literacy, excuse me.
And we're going to be talking more about the priorities certainly in another segment.
Right, but I'll say that they did two bills, big bills last session, about fundamentally changing the way we teach reading in this state. But we're not going to give that time to see if it's working. We got to address that problem more quickly.
One final thing, even though I know we got to end this segment. But before we go forward, we've got to look back. We had four new lawmakers as of Organization Day, one because of a death, sadly, and then three resignations. I mean, does that change the dynamic? You got newbies who, you know...
New committee chairs.
New committee chairs. Yeah. How does that affect it? And briefly, because we will be talking more about...
Now you put me on the spot with the briefly.
All right. Well, that's all we have
time. It could change. It could change. I would like to see some change. But we don't know until they actually get in there, but we shall see.
Fair enough. As much as it helps to know the stories to follow, it's just as helpful to know how the process works. Here's a little explainer to get you up to speed. We'll call it the Indiana General Assembly by the numbers. Like anything that produces winners and losers, the Indiana General Assembly tends to be defined by numbers. As many of us learned back in civics class, Indiana's legislative branch comprises two bodies, the House of Representatives, where 100 members serve two-year terms, and the Senate, where 50 members face voters every 4 years. Based on the 2020 census, each member of the House represents over 67,000 Hoosiers, while each senator answers to over 135,000 constituents. At the moment, Republicans outnumber Democrats 70 to 30 in the House and 40 to 10 in the Senate. Because Republicans constitute supermajorities in both chambers, that is, they make up more than two-thirds of members, they by themselves can provide the quorums necessary to conduct business. Don't assume, though, that party affiliation alone determines how a lawmaker will vote on any given issue. Last year, the General Assembly sent 252 bills to the governor's desk, and more than 91% of them enjoyed some degree of bipartisan support. Now, if all of this seems a bit overwhelming, don't worry. Throughout the session, the team here at Indiana Lawmakers will be working nonstop to sort out what's happening and to explain what it means for you, your family, and your community. After all, for us, that's job one. All right, we look back, time to look forward. Brandon, the conventional wisdom is if you listen to leadership on Organization Day and during their presentations of their agendas, this is not a year where we're going to dig in, as we, with a lot of new topics. We're going to let things sort of percolate, and we did a lot. So we're just going to get what we need to do and hit the road. Is that really going to happen?
The timeline makes it, like we talked about, the compressed timeline of it makes it that you can't do as much.
Fewer committee hearings, fewer limits, fewer bills.
Exactly. Bill limitations on lawmakers. They can only file a certain number of bills, that sort of thing. So literally speaking, yes, they will not get as many bills passed. It's usually about half of the number of bills that pass in a short session as pass in a long session. But it doesn't mean that they're going to tackle any less weighty subjects. I mean, some of the things that legislative leaders have said that they're going to prioritize, things like literacy, the fact that so many kids who don't pass the third grade reading exam are still moving on to fourth grade when they can't, I mean, they aren't literate at the level they need to be. That's a real problem, and it does require attention. Things like chronic absenteeism, that is a huge problem in the state. We've seen those numbers from the state.
In schools we're talking about.
Yes, in schools. Again, a problem you can't afford to wait until the next time to start addressing that. So there are going to be weighty topics that they consider. Childcare, we've mentioned that. Coming out of the last session, the study committee that they worked on that will be something they try to tackle in terms of affording more opportunities to get child care centers open. Now, what that functionally means without spending any money is probably just reducing regulation, which is a debate they'll have to have of, well, you need to keep kids safe, but we don't want to tie up places with too much red tape. Finding the balance there is tricky. So weighty topics, certainly,
right,
just not as many literal bills.
But how realistic is it to think that, okay, we're going to talk about chronic absenteeism, or maybe even truancy. Some I've heard the T word, you know, that haven't heard that word in a long time, but
no,
coming back.
Haven't.
Talking about third grade reading accomplishment and so forth. But can you really talk about school issues without somebody somewhere saying, that brings to mind the very important issue of vouchers. Now, never mind the private school vouchers are already essentially universal, but then we also have parental rights issues, mm-hmm. as we've got a mm-hmm. hefty dose of that. You know, what's taught in the classrooms? Do teachers have to listen for what pronouns kids might be using and changing? I mean, we dealt with all of that in the end of the last session. How realistic is it to think you can mention education or school without somebody saying, oh, this is my cue. I'm going to talk about these other pet issues that, yes, have something to do with school, so I it's germane. I'm going to go talk about these.
I think you're going to have those issues come up. They're going to crop up because, as I think we mentioned in the last segment, nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything moves from the last session to the last session to the last session. Things hold over. Things
still
weren't
grudges.
Resolved.
People are still settling
scores.
Yeah,
that's why was my point. Yeah. Things are not resolved from the last session. People still have grudges, and they're waiting for the opportunity to bring up some of these things. To Brandon's point, we do have to bring up literacy, absenteeism, truancy. Those things have to be talked about because we didn't finish them last year. We did not finish them. I don't know that we'll ever finish them because it seems like we never have. It's always something about education, to your point.
Education reform,
yes.
I always say, is like the highway improvements.
Yes.
If they go a year without it, I'll be shocked.
There's always something wrong with education needs to be fixed. So, but I think we also need to see what needs to be fixed and give it more time to actually be fixed. But we have to do something ASAP about the literacy rates in our state. We have to do something about the retention of third graders. We have to do something now. But what will it be? I don't know. Is science of reading going to work? I don't know. What didn't work before? I can read fine.
Let's dive into this, because a lot of us could, let's say absenteeism, couldn't blame COVID, and certainly absenteeism went up, understandably, but still higher, even though it's improved post-COVID, post-pandemic, it's still higher than it was before, and it's got people scratching their heads.
Well, it strikes me with both of these issues that legislative leaders have talked about, both chronic absenteeism and literacy rates, a lot of this seems to fall, and we'll see what they end up doing. You know, you just pointed out the science of reading, which is what they did last session. We haven't seen that start to work yet. Mm-hmm. That will be playing out over the next few mm-hmm. years, so hopefully that will improve the situation. But it seems like a lot of this is, do we need new laws, or do we just need to better enforce or better utilize the laws that are already on the books?
Or maybe listen to the people who actually do the work more.
Right.
Maybe that's where we're falling short.
But, I mean, even if you have agreement, as I presume we do, that chronic absenteeism is a problem. What is it? 1 in 5 students fall into the category, I think, of chronic absenteeism, which is a lot of students. I mean, even if you have widespread agreement on that, that doesn't mean you don't get into fights over how to solve the problem.
Yeah.
To your point, because some people I'm hearing, you know, we go back to truancy, like we need to get law enforcement involved. We're going to take some parents and They're going to pay a price here in a criminal's prosecution.
Maybe we'll withhold benefits.
Right. I mean, there's a punitive
benefits.
Approach, but then you have other lawmakers and districts that are saying it's definitely here the carrot, not the stick. You know, it's about encouraging kids. You can, you have more opportunities for extracurriculars, and you can, you get this bell and whistle if you show up more. I mean, where does this come down? Because some people are going to say it's like the whole issue over, discipline schools. Some people want to get out the ruler and start whacking, and others just say it's all about charity.
We've gone away from listening to the experts in many instances, and I think the pendulum always swings, and it swings from one extreme to the next. It doesn't, stay in the middle of what actually works. I remember when I was growing up, it was open concept. All the schools were all about open concept because that was the new thing, and everyone thought that was going to help kids be better and learn better. Then it went to, oh, we got to close all the classrooms now that were open because it's not working. Worked fine for me. I don't know, because that's what I grew up in. And I think that's what we're constantly doing, is going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, instead of figuring out, okay, what actually does work. There has to be some discipline, some punishment has to be there, but it doesn't need to be overly punitive. I think there needs to be some rewards. It has to be a balance of reward, punishment.
Well, and this is not one, and it's not even one solution at the same school, for instance,
mm-hmm.
because,
mm-hmm.
And legislative leaders have talked about this too. If an 8-year-old is chronically absent, it's not the 8-year-old's fault.
Right.
Then you're looking at what's going on at home. How can we improve that situation to help make sure that they're getting to school? If a 16-year-old, if a 16-year-old is chronically absent, I'm not sure it's the parents' fault necessarily.
They may not know.
But I think this also goes back to another thing they're going to do that we're talking about, the transition from last year to this year. They tried to remake high school in the last session, which is
more work internship-based practical
exactly.
experience.
Exactly. Yeah, again, exactly. but to make it so that if you want to go to a 4-year, go get a 4-year degree after high school, we've pretty much set up the education system so that that makes sense. If you don't want to do that, if you want to go directly into the workforce or just get a certificate or something like that, and I say just, but if you want to get a certificate or something like that, is the education system best set up for those students? And maybe not. And that's what they're trying to work on. Well, that gets to chronic absenteeism too, because they want to continue tweaking that system to make mm-hmm. more of those opportunities. Mm-hmm. If you can make school more relevant mm-hmm. for someone in high school, because I think a lot of kids will sit in a classroom and go, why do I care about what I'm hearing right now? How is this going to affect the rest of my life? And if you can't make that relevant to them, then why do they want to be there? And so if you do create more of those work-based learning opportunities, if you do say, okay, this is why we're teaching you this, because as soon as you want to, you're going to go out there and start earning money, that I think could help a little bit with that problem.
Well, mm-hmm. I just want to interject. How many times have we listened to actual kids say what they want versus us adults thinking what kids want and what they need?
Well, they're not in school, so nobody knows where they are. You can't
that's
ask
true.
Them. If you could find them,
that's
you could ask the question.
Well, maybe we should go to their homes. Maybe that's where they're at.
I think that's a really good point. Finding out why aren't kids showing up and try to address those problems.
And you pointed out this is not a one-size-fits-all problem. It sometimes varies from building to building. And let me ask you this. When you look at these issues like inadequate reading skills at the third grade level or chronic absenteeism, again, it's not, you can look at the data and the percentages and so forth, but it's not a blanket approach. And it so happens that people of color, English learners, people from lower socioeconomic segments are not reading as well, surprise, surprise, and are not showing up in the classroom for mm-hmm. any number. Family mm-hmm. responsibilities, looking out for siblings.
Disengagement.
Going to court. Yeah. How much does that complicate it? Because does that open the door to this notion that this is not just a education regulatory issue. This is an issue about parents
and society. It's a multi-pronged issue.
Does this open the door to culture wars and a different sort of backdoor to it in a way?
I don't know if it opens the door for culture wars, the haves versus the have-nots. I will hope it opens the door to maybe learning what, because it's not a one-size-fits-all. It can be different from district to district. It can be different in the same district. From, like you said, different building. Depends on your population and what their needs are. And I think one of the things lawmakers have to do is a one-size-fits-all approach. I mean, that's just kind of, we have to make laws to fit everyone. But there needs to be, hopefully, some ways to customize it for what your needs are, because my needs in my school district may not be the same as your needs in your district. And I think that's where the problem often lies, because you have suburban schools fighting with urban schools because there's different needs there, and we often see that tug of war and that tension. Because
which also means it's not an R versus D issue. Sometimes it's rural versus urban. Other things that are likely to come up, if not even over the frustrations and objections of caucus leaders might be. You were quoted recently at a panel as saying you're 1,000%. That's a lot. percent sure that LGBTQ or anti-LGBTQ issues are going to come back. Elaborate on that.
I mean, there's a huge difference between bills being filed and bills moving in the General Assembly. There are a lot of bills filed every year on both ends of the spectrum that just seem crazy. Like, that's never going to happen in a million years. So I'm 1,000% sure that there will be anti-LGBTQ bills filed. I don't know whether they'll move, but, I mean, history tells us they probably... We have Republican supermajorities. They are coming up in an election year, and while you might think that that would mean, oh, they don't want to go to anything too extreme, well, they're not playing to a general election audience anymore. They're playing to a primary
the more extreme,
audience.
It doesn't matter if something's accomplished. We've talked about this before.
Right.
If I appear to be, I'm out there tilting at windmills, it doesn't matter if I've got a sharp... sword, and that windmill is our enemy.
Right.
You're still getting.
I 1,000% agree that it's going to be 1,000%.
Make it 2,000%.
I
want to have more agreement.
I was going to say 2,000. I definitely think there will be bills filed, whether they go anywhere or not, but I definitely think we're going to have the conversation again. because it's not over. And I agree about playing to a different audience. We're not, we kind of want radical now. You kind of want things to be, I guess, what's the nice way of saying radical. Yeah. That's kind of what you're playing to now, is we want to see, we want that now. You're playing to win. It's not playing for compromise anymore. It's not a plan for, it's playing to, for my base. We want to win. And I think that's where we're going to see some more of the LGBTQ.
But also these things, like everything else, these things don't happen in a vacuum. When these bills come up in Indiana, it's not like Indiana created them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We've seen them all over the country in different Republican-led states. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the clues to what are they going to do next here is what are they doing elsewhere?
Well, and sometimes what's happening in neighboring states becomes the argument for or against another measure. And I'm going to give you an example, marijuana reform. You know, we've already heard people, it's a priority for Senate Democrats, as it has been in the past, legalization or at least decriminalization of marijuana, because, and I've heard Senate Greg DeTaylor, the head of Democrats in the Senate, say, you know, we got the neighboring states, we're going to get left behind, essentially. So that doesn't keep issues like that, even though the governor's already said, you know, until federal, it's not going to happen while he's in office.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's not going to keep people from bringing up marijuana reform, you know, kratom reform, which if you really want to get into the subcategories, I'm just proving I know what's going on.
I do want to say this to your point about, I agree, Governor Holcomb has made it clear, without federal action, he doesn't want Indiana to do anything. That seems unlikely to happen in the next year. So while he's governor, it seems unlikely. But I don't think that's a reason why lawmakers at the State House won't do something, because they don't really care that much what Eric Holcomb thinks about a lot of other subjects.
Not at all.
I mean, he's vetoed 7 bills and been overridden, I think, 4 of those times in office. So to a certain extent, they don't care that much what Eric Holcomb thinks about a subject if they want to do it and he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of they don't want to do it at this point, but they are in danger of being left behind.
I think, yes, left behind. There's a lot of money out there now. And we're missing money. I think this happened with gambling. It happened with selling liquor on Sundays. We finally caught up to where people want us to be. And this is the thing for me about listening to your constituents. If people are telling you they want marijuana legalized, why are our legislators legalizing marijuana? What's the problem now? It's not because we care so much about Sundays or the lottery or gambling, because we've shown that when there's money attached to it,
you make
we'll
an interesting point. If lawmakers just read the polls and did what the polls said, there'd be a lot of difference.
I will say this, though. I mean, and because this is a question we get, you know, the audience engagement tools that we use at IPB News, which are terrific, we get this question a lot, which is clearly, overwhelmingly, Hoosiers want marijuana legalization and decriminalization. Why then don't lawmakers do it? It's because when people go to the polls, that's not how they're making their decisions on who to vote for.
That's true.
Well, the session's short. Unfortunately, this discussion on that session is short, too. I didn't even get to ask you if we're finally going to get a state official sandwich, but maybe we'll do a web exclusive on that. You know, that we save the hard-hitting stuff. Thank you, both of you. I appreciate it. It's going to be interesting, and you've given us a much better perspective on what we can expect in the coming months. Again, my guests have been Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting and Oshia Boyd of Mirror Indy. Next week on Indiana Lawmakers, we continue a Hoosier tradition, our annual conversation with the General Assembly's caucus leaders. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwanis, and on behalf of commentator Ed Feigenbaum, who I should point out called in sick this week, WFYI Public Media, and Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House news. Until next week, take care.